Coming to you from the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon, this is Free Culture Radio. I'm Doug McVeigh. Free Culture Radio is an examination of drugs, drug cultures, and the ineluctable, indelible, and indispensable influence of drugs on society. Free Culture Radio neither promotes the use of any drugs, nor condemns people for being involved in drugs. To the extent that drug use presents problems for individuals or society, those problems are made worse and more intractable when drug users are treated as others and ignored, stigmatized, and even brutalized. On this installment of Free Culture Radio, we're going to talk about stimulants. I thought about easing into this subject by doing a show about coffee. I mean, I live in Portland, Oregon, and some stereotypes are earned. Portland is where I learned how to drink coffee. There are many fine coffee shops and coffee roasters in the Portland metro area. There's a cup of strong coffee next to me as I record this. Yeah, coffee would have been the easy way to start this. Never have done things the easy way, though. I mean, what fun is that? No, on this edition of Free Culture Radio, we're going to start the conversation about stimulants by talking about Tina. You know Tina. Crystal, Ice, Addy, Benny's, Upper, Speed, Amphetamine, Methamphetamine, and their analogs. The Drug Policy Alliance recently held its International Reform Conference. One of the panels was on harm reduction for people who use stimulants. We're going to hear from those panelists now. The voices you're going to hear are Mike Discopola with the San Francisco AIDS Foundation, Mindy Vincent with the Utah Harm Reduction Coalition, Isaac Jackson with the Urban Survivors Union, Shiloh Hassanjama with the People's Harm Reduction Alliance, and Daniel Raymond with the Harm Reduction Coalition. The moderator, the first voice you hear in this segment, is Lindsay LaSalle, a staff attorney with the Drug Policy Alliance.
And as a lawyer, I feel like I would be remiss not to point out that there are obviously legal barriers to many of the things that you guys are doing and are putting yourselves on the line. So just want to thank you for doing the work that you do, even without some of the legal and policy protections that Syringe Exchange, for instance, has. So
thank you.
I want to switch now from some of the risks associated with the mode of injection to some of the risks that result from different behaviors associated with stimulant use. So, for instance, research shows that stimulant use is associated with infrequent condom use, with amphetamine use before sex, with trading sex for drugs or money. And so there are risks associated with that type of sexual behavior. And so, Mike, I'm wondering if you can speak to how you've addressed those risks through education and outreach, particularly among MSM, but then more broadly for some of our panelists.
Well, kind of an interesting follow-up from one of the other comments. For the Stonewall Project, you know, our first funding came through the HIV prevention section of the Department of Public Health locally in San Francisco. So we've been really, closely associated with this notion of, how methamphetamine is connected to the transmission of HIV right from the very inception of our programming. So, our programming has really been focused on, HIV, hepatitis C, STI testing and treatment, as treatment progressed, treatment as prevention. And I think that, when we think about sexual behavior, I think we need to be willing to have a conversation with someone about what kind of sex they want to have and what's working about it and what's not working about it. And, to do motivational interviewing around it. It's like, everyone wants to have the best kick-ass sex that they ever have had every single time. But if that's not happening for you right now and you're using, then how can we help you have that experience and not have the downsides? So, those kind of conversations, there's a lot of providers who are unwilling to have that conversation because, service provision, especially around outpatient drug treatment, has been over-focused on abstinence-only care. Funding has been linked to abstinence-only solutions as well. So I'll kind of go back to the sex piece again. This notion that it's condoms, okay, and that's the only option. Let's get over it, people. That's like 15 years ago almost. So if you're talking about condoms only and that's what you're doing, you're not doing what you need to do. Our services are connected to PrEP. So we have PrEP navigation services at the San Francisco AIDS Foundation. A high number of our folks who are in our services or HIV negative or untested, we work with them until they're ready to test. You know, and if you know, and if they're not ready to test, we work with them about getting engaged in our PrEP services so that they can get you know, pre-exposure prophylaxis and they can prevent themselves from getting HIV. You know, outside of you know, for positive folks, treatment as prevention is shown effective. You know, people who are have an undetectable viral load are not transmitting HIV. So for people that we're working with, we kind of do surveys with them to find out their knowledge base of whether or not they feel they're undetectable. And our service rates, our rates of kind of illustrating that for our programming is showing it's above the treatment curve that we're seeing locally. So thank you. I talk really fast, so I'll slow down. You know, 80 to 85% of our folks are reporting that they have undetectable viral loads. That means they're not transmitting HIV. So, you know, we do focus on our folks who are out of treatment. How do they, how do we help them adhere to their HIV treatments when they're using? What are some of those strategies? You know, where you place your medications, who holds your meds, not losing your, you know, how do you accomplish that, you know? And talk about kind of the different options. You know, there's condom use. There's serosorting, so, you know, having sex only with other positive guys or having a conversation with that. And honestly, that happens all the time. And if you look at the apps, the hookup apps, people are doing that, and they're doing it naturally all the time. So acknowledging the behaviors, as Charlotte was talking about, for participants who are already using these harm reduction strategies. And then helping them understanding what their other options are, you know, dealing with the anxiety that folks may have around getting on PrEP. They're like, I'm not, you know, like, what would it mean for them? What are the side effects? You know, all those kind of things. Navigating the insurance portion of getting someone onto PrEP, it can be relatively complicated in some environments. It's less complicated with healthcare reform. But the other piece of that is also educating providers and finding providers in your communities who would be willing to give PrEP to drug users and to people who are meth users in particular. And you know, we have a particular expertise at our program of doing that and of having those conversations. Every single treatment plan for anyone that we work with includes thinking about sexual health, HIV, primary care, and drug and alcohol treatment goals. You know, and I'll give an example. You know, we were working with someone in our contingency management program, and which is a program that gives monetary compensations for urines that are free from stimulants. We have lots of people that are injecting, and you know, having a conversation with someone about how much they're loading in their rig, and you know, be willing to kind of have a conversation about setting up a plan, trying out something new, having a discussion afterward about how that was useful and not useful, you know, what worked about it, what didn't work about it, you know, having a conversation with them about the things, and you know, that moment actually of having that conversation with so many people are like, you're gonna talk with me about how much I'm loading in my rig, right? I'm like, yeah, we are gonna talk to you about that. We're gonna have a conversation about that. We're gonna have a conversation about you loading your own rig maybe and learning how to inject yourself. If you're having other people inject you, what that means. And you know, and with the sex piece is kind of like, how long do you go? You know, are you going for 5 days? Are you going for 3 days? If you wanna have kick-ass sex, what's your sex like? What's the sex like after 5 days? So, you know, having these kind of conversations, and what we find is people are, you know, able to kind of make steps in the direction of having the kind of sex that they want and reducing the harms, and then kind of realizing like, wow, this creates space in my life to think about my life in a different way. I actually have the possibility of being successful, meeting goals. I actually am a useful individual. I can make change in my life. I have power. You know, hope is that, you know, what I always say is, you know, in our programming, we hold hope for people until they're able to hold hope for that for themselves. And I think the reason for that is because so many of our systems of care say, you'll never get better. Your brain will never heal. Well, that's...
Yes. Yeah, Shiloh.
So, I think it's really important that, you know, we also acknowledge some of the power dynamics within the drug-using culture. And I'm going to do a shout-out to Joe Puccio. She had a really great idea that, like, I feel like an idiot that I did surrender change almost 15 years without doing this. And people would come up and say, hey, I want syringes, and they want syringes too. And there'd be these couples that, like, are these partners who wouldn't, you know, like, there'd be this clearly imbalanced power dynamics. And so she came up with this plan to say, hey, you speak for yourself and you ask for what you want. No one tells you what you want. No one tells you you got enough cookers or you didn't, you know, all this stuff. And so you walk up as a couple and you kind of start breaking down some of that own power dynamics, and you say, you can get 200, but he or she's going to speak for themselves, actually, and they're going to tell us exactly what they want, and they're going to get exactly what they want. And I think it's important to also engage people as individuals and try to support people who are in these situations that they feel powerless, and give them back their power, because I think the most intelligent and most thoughtful and the most innovative outreach worker I've ever met have always been active participants.
Any other strategies or thoughts around mitigating sexually risky behavior associated with stimulants, or thoughts generally from?
Well, I also want to talk about kind of the notion of SM and other, you know, kind of behaviors, and kind of how people can kind of look at what behaviors are really comfortable and enjoyable to them, and how to negotiate how to think about boundaries related to that, and how to negotiate that. Even just thinking about, like, you know, having regular sexual partners with whom you trust, you know, with whom you can do, maybe, you know, you can have an SM relationship with, and things like that, and what circumstances or situations tend to put you at more risk, and how you can prevent those things. So having conversations about that as well, but I'll let other people.
Daniel?
Yeah, I've been thinking about this over the last few years in the context. We started seeing this pop up in Europe in particular, that there were these HIV positive guys who were having sex with other guys and getting hepatitis C. And there was a whole cluster of factors involved with it, like having, being in group sex situations, using drugs alongside of sex, sometimes, you know, some other kind of factors in there. And so we don't see a whole lot of hepatitis C transmitted through sex compared to transmitted through, it's a bloodborne infection, so it's mostly transmitted blood-to-blood contact, especially things like injection drug use with shared equipment. So we don't have a whole lot of experience doing this, but I mean, I think as Mike was saying, these seem to be guys who are having the kind of sex that they wanted to have, right? And if hepatitis C was a consequence of that, then is the answer to say, let's talk to them about safer sex, let's ask them to modify their behavior, let's ask them to make more trade-offs between what they want to do and what some public health authority's interest is in reducing transmission? Or is the goal to say, listen, hepatitis C is curable, right? The more cases of hepatitis C that we cure, the fewer cases of transmission there will be. So similar with HIV, like, Are we ignoring the structural factors, right, that allow these viruses to circulate in different contexts, versus saying we need to focus on behavior, we need to focus on education? So I personally think that the methamphetamine and stimulants give us an opportunity to step back from sort of the 90s kind of 2000 style of public health, where it was all about that we've got to talk to you about condoms, we've got to talk to you about risk and make you care about the risk in the same way we think you should care about risk, we should talk to you about changing your behavior, and look at those structural factors, and look at a broader sexual and emotional health kind of trajectory for people whose goals may not be avoidance of hepatitis C or HIV. That might not be their primary goal, and their primary goals might be more salient to them, and also things that feel more under their control, and things that we could support them on.
Absolutely, and stimulant use in some contexts can be, in and of itself, a harm reduction measure. If you think about sex workers, for instance, who might use it to increase their libido or to make their work more pleasurable, or so that they are less afraid of abuse. I think it is broadening out our framework of understanding these, you know, risky behaviors and helping to reconceptualize it. Isaac, do you want to chime in here, and then we'll move on.
Yeah, I think that. But one thing that should be discussed a little bit is, in San Francisco, there's been the appearance of fentanyl and methamphetamine and crack, And I think a lot of people don't know that yet who smoke these drugs. So it's really important to do any method of doing these drugs. I think it's really important to get the word out that this is happening, and to start testing the drugs on a regular basis so people know that the, you know, that you're doing a stimulant and an opioid at the same time, which is you know, it's a health hazard if you don't know that you're doing that, right?
You are listening to Free Culture Radio. I'm your host, Doug McVeigh. This installment of Free Culture Radio begins our look at stimulants and stimulant cultures. We're listening to a panel on harm reduction for people who use stimulants that took place at the Drug Policy Alliance's International Reform Conference, which took place in October 2017 in Atlanta, Georgia. Let's get back to that panel, which included Mike Discopola with the San Francisco AIDS Foundation, Mindy Vincent with the Utah Harm Reduction Coalition, Isaac Jackson with the Urban Survivors Union, Shiloh Hassan-Jama with the People's Harm Reduction Alliance, Daniel Raymond with the Harm Reduction Coalition, and the moderator, Lindsay LaSalle, with the Drug Policy Alliance.
But apart from the technical language, how do we really ensure that these services, if they get implemented in the United States, bring in people who use stimulants and offer services that are particular to them? And Daniel, I'll go ahead and start with you on that one.
Yeah, I mean, going back to what Shiloh and others have said, I mean, this is a design issue, right? If you want among your kind of customers for your product to include people using stimulants, what features and factors are most attractive and appealing to them, and what barriers or signals would kind of keep them from wanting to use it, right? So it could be anything from hours to location to sets of kind of guidelines or rules to even like the kind of feel and the flow of the space. I think that there's a kind of evolving discussion amongst different communities in the U.S. where there's advocacy happening about what kinds of spaces work for what kinds of people, right? And what you're looking for in those kinds of spaces. Are you looking for not just a place to get in off the street and consume your drugs and then go back out on the street, but like move through into a different space, into a chill out space or into a cafe or into a place like, you know, maybe some stimulant users want crossword puzzles and coloring books after, you know, I think it's similar to probably some of the lessons that Mike was talking about for the Stonewall Project. So it's that, you know, it's that combination of not just assuming one size fits all and really doing, you know, involving and consulting people who use stimulants throughout the process, you know, ideally bringing them into leadership roles in that. And then also kind of carrying through and making sure that you don't inadvertently kind of make compromises that will have consequences that push certain people out or raise the threshold of entry down the road.
Shiloh, do you want to add anything? And then we'll move on, but I'm going to come to you.
I think we are in a dangerous place when it comes to consumption rooms, and we have a lot of grass top organizations, and we have a lot of people who have no knowledge of what's on the ground making policy decisions that will affect how these services work. And I think we, you know, in Seattle, I fought really hard to get smoking in the plan, and they pushed back, and now public health has no intention to even include them, even though that was part of the system. And they say, oh, no, we'll figure this out later, maybe a decade or two afterwards, which we know is probably not going to happen. I think that the fact that we're not including drug users on all aspects, and the fact that we don't have, you know, one of the things when we started looking into safe consumption rooms and we started creating these boards to do it, we did a majority of drug users and some medical professionals, but we wanted to make sure the drug users could always outvote the medical professionals, and that we start deciding things based on science. And I think, you know, to be perfectly honest, I'm terrified about safe consumption rooms because we have sold our people out. We have sold our soul just to accomplish a gold star. And I don't want a gold star. I want something that our people are going to use and our people that are going to save our people's lives. And our people are dying day. And the people who are organizing these SIFs are dying overdose and dying, and I am over compromising, and so you probably didn't want to ask me this question, but it's time.
Of course I did.
It's time for us to take back our goddamn movement, and it's time for us to start fighting and not surrendering, and these medical professionals and these things you need to do, all these groups, is like, it needs to be, it does not rock and science. We have operated multiple shooting galleries and multiple using places for decades. And you know what? People have not died in those places, right? And it doesn't take rock and sciences, you know, and it's time for us to move on. And I'm tired. If someone is telling you we need to slow down, then you need to get them the out of the room.
Okay. Yeah, Mike. Right. Briefly.
I just want to add also that you can, you know, use the systems that work in terms of systems of power. The medical establishment, there are people in the ERs that are behind this movement, that are behind the notion of supervised consumption spaces, even spaces for smokers. So where are the power players in the room, and how do you build political will? You know, I'm all for the activists, for the side of it, but we also, when we get the attention, we have to get the attention around the systems of care that hold the power.
Isaac, briefly.
Yeah, I think what's happening to the safe injection facility issue, at least in San Francisco, is being kind of pushed into the same space as dealing with homeless people or the homeless issue. And then we all know what the answer will be eventually. We can't afford it. It's too expensive. You know, I've been working with the coalition people trying to put together this SIF in San Francisco, really great group of people. And I've been trying to say, hey, you know what, this it should be a building where people, it could be drug user community center as well as SIF. I mean, it could be places where people can meet, it could be classes, education, you know, a lot of different things. And I think that's the way to go, rather than have it be, you know, just, because some people want to have it so that it's kind of like a traveling feast. It's a different nonprofits have different, you know, safe injection sites. And I think that's great. I think we should have it all. I mean, I think that should happen, and then we should have, you know, standalone building. I think, you know, why is it always either or, you know? I think we should have as much alternatives and examples as possible, because we really don't know what's going to work. And it's going to change. But right now, the housing situation in San Francisco has created a whole new class of people shooting up on the street that probably, I don't think they would be there without people being displaced by housing. Mm-hmm. So I think it's something to look at in the future, how harm reduction is going to deal with this, because we haven't really been dealing with housing issues that much as a movement, I don't think.
Yeah, actually, again, you set me up perfectly for my transition, though, and I want to go to Mindy first, which is, we've been talking a lot about very specific interventions, syringe exchange, supervised consumption, but I want to talk for a few minutes about the need to really broaden the notion of what harm reduction is, particularly for this community, looking at something like housing. If we provided homeless people with housing, would they have to use stimulants to stay up all night in order to be able to protect themselves from abuse on the street? So I'm wondering if you guys can just talk through a few minutes about, like, what is really needed in the broad sense to protect the health and well-being of people who use stimulants.
So it is my belief, as a clinician, I believe that you can do therapeutic and clinical interventions with people who are actively using substances. I think that we need to stop requiring abstinence of people before we apply our clinical interventions. So that people can start to build a better life for themselves. Like, I'm sure there are plenty of people who are using drugs every day and feel very happy about where their lives are. The vast majority of the people that I serve are not happy about where their lives are. They're waking up sick every day, and they don't have their children, and they're disconnected from their families, and they're homeless, and they don't have a job. And they are not super stoked about that, you know? And those are things that I can help them with. You know, if we can get people into housing, you know, because that, I mean, that's a huge issue on its own. But if we also can, you know, I'm a fan of dialectical behavior therapy. I know for sure I can teach people skills that will help them better manage their lives, even if they're using. I'm a big fan of eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. I truly believe, and this is from my own experience, and my experience is my truth, and yours is yours, you know, but I was an addict for 17 years, and today I am cured of the disease of addiction because I healed the traumas of my past. I built protective factors in my life, and I learned new coping skills. I can help people have all of those things while they're in active addiction, and often people will transition out of it. You know, there's so many things we can provide for people to help them find themselves in a better place, you know, and that is really what matters to me. Like, the people I serve, I love those people. I love them with all of my heart, and I believe in them, and I have lost some of the greatest people that were ever put on this planet to overdose, you know, and if we can prevent any of that, I believe in every person I serve. I know that they can do things with their lives. I know that they don't have to stay in the situation they're in, but they don't have any opportunity, and we put all these requirements upon people before we'll help them get out of it. You know, it's like, have fun in your hole. Here's some more dirt. We're going to kick on you. But I'm sure if you want it bad enough, you could climb out any time. You know, and that we just have to stop doing that. Sorry, I'll get crazy. I'm going to step off my soapbox.
And that's it for this edition of Free Culture Radio. I'm grateful to the Drug Policy Alliance for arranging that panel on harm reduction for people who use stimulants. My thanks to all the panelists. Mike Discopola with the San Francisco AIDS Foundation, Mindy Vincent with the Utah Harm Reduction Coalition, Isaac Jackson with the Urban Survivors Union, Shiloh Hassanjama with the People's Harm Reduction Alliance, Daniel Raymond with the Harm Reduction Coalition, and the moderator, Lindsay LaSalle, with the Drug Policy Alliance. Many thanks to our engineer, and thanks especially to you, dear listener, for your support. You make it all worth it. Free Culture Radio is produced at the studios of KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon. We have a webpage at kboo.fm/freeculture. Free Culture Radio has a Facebook page. It's facebook.com/kboofreecultureradio. Please give it a like. You can find links there to past shows, announcements about upcoming programs and events, and other stuff like news items that may be of interest. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm at Doug McVeigh. We'll be back in a month to continue our examination of drugs, drug cultures, and the influence of drugs on society. Thanks again for listening. I'm Doug McVeigh. Good night.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Thanks for Giving, a Give Guide Happy Hour with Human Solutions, ERCO, and KBOO on Monday, November 20th at 5 p.m. at the Lagunitas Community Room in Portland. Human Solutions is partnering with KBOO and ERCO to say thank you to their donors and to celebrate being included in this year's Willamette Week Give Guide. The evening includes beer and snacks as a way of saying thanks for giving to all their supporters. Again, that's Thanks for Giving, a Give Guide Happy Hour with Human Solutions, ERCO, and KBOO on Monday, November 20th at 5 p.m. at the Lagunitas Community Room, 237 Northeast Broadway Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Community Advisory Board will meet Tuesday, November 21st at 6 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Fixed Fair, Saturday, November 18th. At 9:30 a.m. at Ron Russell Middle School in Portland. The Portland Fixed Fair is a free event featuring exhibits and workshops from numerous community partners throughout the day. Experts will be able to talk about water and energy, savings, home and personal health, food and nutrition, community resources, recycling, yard care, and more. Free childcare and lunch are provided. The event features free workshops in English and Spanish. Again, that's the Portland Fixed Fair, Saturday, November 18th at 9:30 a.m. at Ron Russell Middle School in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 7 o'clock on the dot, and next is Combined Culture Radio. Stay tuned.
Trippin' in the NY fleets, one player, no biggie, dub C. And trade D, keep in no boot, can't click it, we was fool, still flippin', try heat. First of the month, read up 15th. Quarter punch, ice cream trucks, police. Stay tryin' like the foes, wagging out the set, so we shot up, no peace. No love, not clicking up, swipe meat, white cheese. Then a Glock in the trunk, oh geez. Tryin' tellin' about the game, but it don't add up, cause the not the same.
Yeah, don't add up, cause the not the same. Yeah, don't add up, cause the not the same. Yeah, don't add up, cause the not the same. Yeah, don't add up, cause the.
Yeah, time to show them bitches who the man. Pin me head strong, pin me head strong. Time to show them bitches who the man. Pin me head strong, pin me head strong. Time to show them bitches who the man. Pin me head strong, pin me head strong. Time to show them bitches who the man. Pin me head strong. Well, I was born by the river, not